Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Concern worldwide with the new strain of the coronavirus. Countries everywhere are now shutting off Southern Africa. Public health experts there are angry.
Why are we locking away Africa when this virus is already on three continents? Nobody's locking away Belgium. Nobody's locking away Israel. Why are we locking away Africa?
Also today, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison says cancel culture is real and he wants to do something about it.
Australians shouldn't have to worry about looking over their shoulder, fearful of offending an anonymous person on Twitter.
And the U.S. desperately needs long-haul truckers. Immigrants like this Afghan-American are driving and recruiting others.
I told them, you know, just we can get you guys a truck. You guys can be on the road and make good money on this.
I'm Marco Werman. That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to be with you today. By now, you've probably been hearing a lot about the 15th letter in the Greek alphabet, Omicron. That's the new variant of the coronavirus. It was detected in southern Africa last week. Understanding just how serious Omicron may or may not be will take some time. Today, President Biden urged patience and calm.
This variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists. And we're learning more every single day.
Still, many countries, especially in the West, are taking major precautions, including imposing travel bans on countries in southern Africa. It might seem intuitive to stop travel in order to limit the spread of a new variant, but as the world's Ilana Gordon reports, such bans may do more harm than good.
Horia Tagali says she and her colleagues in South Africa have been racing around the clock to sequence and track this new Omicron variant.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of pressure. And the world was worried, and we wanted to get data out because we had the samples. We wanted to get the data out.
She says ever since they helped identify the beta variant last year, scientists in South Africa have really ramped up their surveillance efforts for new variants. They wanted to catch the next one even faster. And they did, thanks to an alert from scientists in Botswana. But Tagali knew what would happen next.
England has suspended its flights from six nations.
President Biden wasted no time barring air travel from eight African countries.
To activate the emergency brake on travel from countries in southern Africa.
The U.S., the EU, and others announced travel bans from southern Africa, just as cases were then identified in other places, from Canada to the U.K. to Israel. The bans sparked outrage from the places that were targeted. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa.
These restrictions are completely unjustified and unfairly discriminate against our country and our southern African sister countries.
It's not clear if this variant even originated in southern Africa. It was just identified there. Malawi's president posted on social media that the bans are a sign of Afrophobia. Dr. Ayoade Alakisha, co-chair of Africa Union's Vaccine Delivery Alliance, further slammed the responses on the BBC.
Why are we locking away Africa when this virus is already on three continents? Nobody's locking away Belgium. Nobody's locking away Israel. Why are we locking away Africa? It is wrong.
Georgetown's Lawrence Gostin says the rage is justified.
In a way, we're just flying blind.
Gostin is part of a national committee reviewing the evidence for travel bans and restrictions.
Travel bans seem so intuitive that you can keep a virus out, and there's enormous political pressure to do them. But whatever evidence we do have shows that they're not effective.
Countries like China that put in strict border measures early have been able to keep infections down at a cost. But Gostin says without global coordination, SARS-CoV-2 can find a way around any one ban.
We've seen very late, inconsistent, and porous travel bans, not realizing that, you know, somebody from Southern Africa, you know, flies to Europe and then flies into the United States, you know, without any restrictions.
Historically, Gostin says bans have caused more harm than good in health emergencies. During the West African Ebola outbreak, countries closed down borders and focused on readying for their own potential outbreaks. That resulted in less resources and support going to the places that needed it most, those at the center of the outbreak. Kelly Lee researches cross-border measures at Simon Fraser University in Canada.
As Omicron makes its way around the world, we have to see borders not as a stop point, but more as a surveillance point.
She says consistent screening at borders for the virus is what could make a difference.
Testing everyone, not just testing people coming from Southern Africa.
The World Health Organization discourages countries from enacting travel bans. A major worry is it may disincentivize countries from reporting in the future. As for Tigali, the scientist in Southern Africa who's been sequencing Omicron, she says it hasn't been easy to do this work since the bans.
As scientists, this really is our job to inform, and then people are very angry at us. People are very, very angry at us. South Africans are very angry.
She says she understands. People are suffering from the closures, economically. Still, she says she remains focused on the work and sharing what she learns. She hopes that one day we all can get ahead of this pandemic. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Zimbabwe is one of the countries that is now targeted by international flight restrictions because of the Omicron variant. Godfrey Musuka is in the capital, Harare, where he runs Columbia University's ICAP Global Health Program. Godfrey, what are people saying about the travel bans now being imposed by other countries on people coming from South Africa, Zimbabwe, several other countries from the region?
There's a lot of concern. The feeling was that it was too abrupt and that many people are stranded within the region. And Southern African countries seem to feel that although they shared this important information, to some extent, they would have thought that other countries would not have necessarily banned them because this information is for the good of everyone.
What are your own personal thoughts about the travel ban for people who might have the Omicron variant?
I can see the logic. Certainly, every country has to do whatever they think is best to protect their citizens. But if one is stuck here, on holiday, some are running out of money. So there's that concern about protecting public health in the banning countries, but there's also the concern of the individuals who are also stuck in Southern Africa.
Right, and it's not just those people from other countries that are stuck down there. I mean, it's your own citizens. So tell us about your border with South Africa and your concern with the movement of people right now.
We do get a lot of traffic to and fro between Zimbabwe, South Africa, and other countries. And as we are approaching the Christmas holiday, the New Year holidays, we are expecting a large movement of people. So from past experience, from last year, we saw that there wasn't effective testing at the border post. So a lot of individuals who were positive were able to move between various countries, and that contributed to spread of COVID.
So do you favor travel restriction into Zimbabwe from South Africa?
Travel restrictions don't necessarily work. We have a very porous border between Zimbabwe and South Africa. The Zimbabwean border is the busiest in Southern Africa. So even if you close the official border, there are many unofficial channels. So you still have a lot of people crossing over. What I think is important is to provide testing so that every individual who is going across the border is tested, and those individuals who test positive, we have adequate provision for their quarantine. I think that's probably a better way than closing the border.
So, Godfrey, you work closely with the Minister of Health in Zimbabwe to combat COVID there. What are your own concerns about Omicron?
I think the biggest concern is that we don't know enough about this variant. Is it substantially worse than Delta or not? We don't know that. How quickly is it going to spread? What are the fatalities? So all those are concerns. But I'm hopeful that in the coming few weeks, it will become more clearer as more data and more information becomes available, in particular from South Africa, which appears for now to be the epicenter.
What is the state of vaccinations in Zimbabwe right now, Godfrey?
Zimbabwe currently has one of the highest vaccination rates on the African continent. About 43% of Zimbabweans have received at least one dose of vaccine, but there are gaps that we continue to be worried about. And vaccination has not been made available to individuals who are 16 years or younger. So those are key gaps. We do have enough vaccines in country to meet the demand, if not more than what the current demand is. So what is important is to encourage people to present themselves for vaccination.
Is Zimbabwe prepared if there is a surge caused by Omicron?
We saw with the last Delta wave that certainly ICU beds were used up and the supply chain for oxygen was put under extreme stress. Mm. These have not substantially improved over the last 6 months. So if there's a substantial increase in individuals needing hospitalization, oxygen, and other supplies, we might surely struggle.
What does moving forward in Zimbabwe need to look like at this point?
I think what is important for us as Zimbabweans is that we learned a lot from the Delta-driven third phase. If a more aggressive wave comes, we need more clinical staff available, more beds. We need to get more people vaccinated so that if they do become infected, they are likely to have less severe signs.
Godfrey Mosuka, he runs the Zimbabwe program for ICAP Global Health at Columbia University. He's been speaking with us from Harare. Godfrey, thank you very much for explaining this.
Thank you so much.
There's nothing like tucking into your local bar for a beer and live music on a cold winter night. On Friday, that's exactly what a few dozen people in England had planned when they arrived at the UK's highest altitude pub. As they downed their pints and listened to the Oasis cover band, snow was falling outside. It kept falling. Manager of the Tan Hill Inn, Nicola Townsend, told a local radio show that by 9 p.m. she knew the crowd at the pub was not going to be making it out.
So we ended up with some people sleeping on the floor and on sofas and sharing rooms.
Around 60 people woke up to more than 3 feet of snow on Saturday. Cars were covered. Fallen power cables made the roads inaccessible. But luckily, the small inn is off the grid and still had power. So everyone decided to make the most of it. The cover band, called Noasis, took the stage again on Saturday night. Manager Nicola Townsend told Sky TV there was plenty of food and booze. It turns out, no surprise, that a remote English inn is not the worst place to be stuck.
We've had karaoke, we've had quizzes, we've had board games, card games, people helping to clear tables, wash up. Everybody's got on board with it all. It's been amazing.
As the weekend went on, the snow stayed put, and so did the people at the pub. The band and others without a room reservation still had to get some sleep. Saturday night passed, Sunday night passed.
And we're still here, all together, still on Monday morning.
But you know the saying, all good things must come to an end. By this afternoon, the road was cleared and the pub bid farewell to the guests. They got a little more than they asked for, but it's a weekend they'll never forget. Take it away, Noasis. The stage is yours. Just ahead, new drivers are getting behind the wheel for long-haul trucking routes. And in Canada, a 911 call for Quebec's strategic reserves of maple syrup. You're listening to The World.
Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Maybe you were one of the millions of Americans who took a long drive over the Thanksgiving holiday. Multiply that time on the road by several hours, even days, and you'll begin to understand the life of a long-haul trucker. For years now, a shortage of truck drivers in the U.S. has been building. But as The World's Monica Campbell reports, there's a whole new crop of truck drivers eager to hit the road.
How long have you been on the road?
Since last night. It was 5 p.m. from Oregon to here, Morgan Hill.
Morgan Hill, California, near San Francisco. It's where I meet Mohammed Nabi Mohammadi during one of his drives as a long-haul trucker. Today, his truck is filled with Christmas trees.
I go all over the state, so like most of the time I stay on the road for 15 days, then I go home.
To Fort Worth, Texas, to see his wife and kids. Mohammadi is new to the trucking world. He's from Afghanistan and arrived in the States a few years ago after working as an interpreter for the U.S. military. He saved up and bought his own truck, a white 56-footer. Inside, there are two sleep lofts, a fridge, and some flaming hot Cheeto wrappers on the floor.
That's huge. It's very big.
Mohammadi says it's tough work. There's long stretches away from home. It's physically taxing. And there are the hazards of the road.
It's very dangerous. So snow and the road gets a lot of accidents. You will see.
He has hired a fellow Afghan to drive with him, Saeed Obadullah Sadat.
We are like as a like kind of family, you know.
Yeah, we work together as a family, like as a team and a family.
Before, they both worked at an Amazon warehouse in Texas. Trucking is better, they say, and it's also pretty easy to get into. After you get your license, maybe your own truck, you're good to go. That's what's attracted drivers from Central America, Mexico, and parts of Asia to the industry. In California, nearly half of the truck drivers are immigrants. Many are replacing older white drivers.
You know, oftentimes there's stories of immigrants setting up shop in America with small businesses and really succeeding, and a lot of trucking is a small business.
David Carell is a research scientist at MIT who studies trucking. He also says that no matter who's driving, frustrations can build up. Trucking can mean a lot of unpaid time waiting for other people to come and load and unload stuff off the trucks.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of just waiting and downtime.
The Biden administration's infrastructure bill might ease some of the industry's problems, including these lag times. One big goal is to attract more drivers. Some trucking companies can't wait for government intervention and are recruiting from outside the U.S. Layla Sinanovich is with Alcatraz, a trucking company in St. Louis, Missouri. They're about to offer work visas to drivers from places that might seem surprising.
Mainly right now, our top focus is Poland and Ukraine.
The family business has roots in those countries, and there are growing Polish and Ukrainian communities in Missouri. The company will likely pay its new drivers about $47,000 a year, the average industry wage.
And if we have a good return on it, then we will be doing this very often.
I have to deliver that load today as well.
So I need two volunteers to go in the truck.
In California, Mohammadi watches as the Christmas trees are loaded off his truck and tells me how he wants to expand his trucking business.
Long term, I'm planning for the mechanic shop.
He doesn't see driving much longer himself. He wants to set up a body shop for trucks in Texas and hire more drivers, likely fellow Afghans.
Yes. I told him, you know, just we can get you guys a truck and you guys can be on the road and make good money on this.
So we might be seeing a whole new group of people from Afghanistan becoming truck drivers in the United States.
A lot.
At least if Mohammadi has anything to do with it. And with that, he has to head on to his next stop, Los Angeles, and then eventually home to rest. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Morgan Hill, California.
Most of the world's maple syrup comes from the forests of Canada. And if you are a pancake lover or simply just love the stuff, Bad news. Canada is low on supplies. So our neighbors to the north are releasing syrup from their strategic reserves to keep prices stable. Yep, Canada is prepared. I'm joined by Benoit Côté, a forestry expert at McGill University. He joins us from Quebec. I'm struck, Benoit, by the contrast of the U.S. releasing 50 million barrels of oil from its oil reserves very recently. Meantime, Quebec's releasing 50 million pounds of syrup. I mean, symbolism aside, is the logic basically the same? Keep supplies up and therefore prices down?
Well, we just want to meet the demand, right? It's a matter of price, but basically making sure that the market gets all the maple syrup that it can get.
Mm, people love it. I mean, why is drawing on the reserve necessary? What made this year so bad for producers that you had to tap the reserves?
Well, we had in 2021, it was not a great year. It was an average year. We produced 133 million pounds of maple syrup. Unfortunately, with COVID, actually, the demand for maple syrup has increased drastically. So with an average year and increased demand, significant increase in demand for maple syrup, we had to use some of our reserve, and basically we're using 50% of it to meet the demand.
So 50 million pounds of syrup pulled from the strategic maple syrup reserves. Is it unusual to pull so much syrup from the reserve?
As far as I know, this is the biggest amount we have ever taken from the reserve, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how many gallons is 50 million pounds of maple syrup? Do you know off the top of your head?
A gallon of maple syrup, you're taking me by surprise here, but it's a bit heavier than a gallon of water. So I would say it's about 5 million gallons of maple syrup that would be put on the market.
Wow. Well, thank you for the image. I can see that. So I lived in the maple syrup zone for a few years, so I know you need very specific conditions for the sugar maples, freezing nights mixed with days above freezing, which gets the sap flowing. But I've read that climate change is impacting that fragile and precise balance. What has it done, and how big of a concern is that for producers?
It is a concern, but it hasn't had much of an effect yet on the production of maple syrup. Last year was an average year, but the best year ever was actually 2020. Before that, it was the year before, 2019. We've done some research on this. We know that the season actually will change, and the timing of the season will change. We already have seen that, actually. On average, it probably starts about a week before, let's say then 20 or 30 years ago. So, but we see this by 2050, probably maybe 2 weeks before, and then, of course, by 2100, it will start even earlier. But the length of the season is likely to stay the same.
So, Benoit, what are the biggest threats to Quebec's maple industry right now? Do you have concerns?
We have concerns, yes, because global climate change will have effects on windstorms. We also have problem with insects, new exotic insects, and we're quite worried.
How important is this industry to Quebec's overall economy?
Overall, I mean, for the economy of the province, I mean, that's a minor component. What we have to be concerned with is everything else that goes around it, the restaurant, I mean, the sugar shack, the parties, the weddings and everything. And that's where actually COVID took a beating on all this industry.
What about you, Benoit? I mean, I know you study this stuff, but are you a fan of maple syrup? Do you eat a lot of the stuff?
I do, actually. I do. I don't eat a lot of my maple syrup. My kids do. So it's.
Is there always a bottle in the fridge?
There is always a bottle in the fridge, and I have a few bottles and cans, actually, in my food room.
Nice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Benoit Côté is a forestry expert at McGill University. He joined us from Sainte-Anne-de-Bellevue, Quebec. Thank you very much, Benoit.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. Power cuts, an economy in free fall. It felt like things couldn't get worse in Lebanon. Now one of its key export markets says, we don't want your stuff.
This is a big impact for us. We will lose in 2022 around $400 or $500 million export to Saudi Arabia.
Lebanon's downward economic spiral still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH. Sudan has a new prime minister. It's the previous prime minister who's now back in office. Abdallah Hamdok was deposed in a military coup a little over a month ago. He was reinstated in a deal last week by Sudan's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Through it all, protests against the military coup have continued across Sudan. In recent weeks, security forces have killed more than 40 demonstrators. The World's Halima Gikandi is in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, and is on the line with me. So what is the mood right now there?
Well, the moon in Khartoum is very energized and defiant. There were massive protests on Thursday, then some follow-up demonstrations, pro-democratic demonstrations over the weekend. Every day, demonstrators are planning in their local neighborhoods, planning the next demonstrations, planning the next acts of civil disobedience. And so are political leaders. Some political detainees who were detained by the military a couple weeks ago are now being released, although not all. And when they get the chance, once they're released, the first thing they do, including today, is go out, make a statement about how fed up they are with the military and how many feel betrayed by Prime Minister Hamdok, who has since entered an agreement with them.
And Halima, what about the deal signed between the military and Prime Minister Hamdok last week? I mean, is that enough to send a message to protesters that this is a compromise they can support?
No. And in fact, after the deal was signed last week, it seems like people are even more energized, both against the military and against Prime Minister Hamdok. This deal came to a surprise to many, mostly because it was signed only between the Prime Minister Hamdok and the military. It did not include the political parties who had been in this transitional government. It did not include the professional body of activists who are politically significant. And that's why so many of these protesters are rejecting the deal completely. They do not want to see the military in power in any capacity. So now Prime Minister Hamdok is in a position where the own streets that had been supporting him have now turned against him.
So as activists and the civil society class continue to protest against the military, what do people on the streets say they want?
People say very directly, we want the military to go back to the barracks. We do not want them in the government. That is the clear message that I hear every day. And that was initially what the hope and the goal was that was supposed to come out of this civilian-military agreement that's been in the works for the past 2 years. The whole point of it was to eventually lead and steer Sudan towards democracy, towards a civilian-led government. But when the military took over and arrested civilian leaders, detained the prime minister, that completely upended the goal, which is why many people feel like there's no turning back. There's no way you can trust the military after there had been this plan for the government that was now completely upended. And that's why people are continuing to protest.
And yet the military in Sudan has a long history in politics there. So it's not surprising to a lot of people that the generals are slow to back away from power. Do people there see a path forward to something different, maybe a more democratic system?
They do. I mean, when I was in visiting the protests on Thursday, you see a huge cross-section of society, young, old, men, women, children only a couple feet tall, and they all had the same dream, the same ambition of a different Sudan. And this is where I really have to point out that, you know, the streets, the protesters, they had political power. 2 years ago, when they went out on the streets, that led Omar al-Bashir, the former dictator who had been in power for more than 30 years, to have to step down. And then after that, when it seemed like similar to now that the military was now going to take over, people went back on the streets. You know, and many lost their lives for doing that in order to push for what then became the civilian transitional government. So the protesters do actually have political power in Sudan, and that's what they're trying to use this time around. There have been some new freedoms that people have gotten in the past couple of years with this new transitional government, and people don't want to go back. In fact, I spoke with one activist who works in one of these neighborhood resistance committees that are constantly planning this very, very local level civil disobedience. And he said straight to me, we win or we die. Wow. And that's what I hear all the time here.
Interesting times in Sudan. Halima Gakandi, the world's Africa correspondent, speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Thank you very much, Halima.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Honduras held its presidential election yesterday. The candidate representing a coalition of liberal parties holds a commanding lead. Her name is Xiomara Castro. If she is officially recognized as the new president, Castro would mark the end of more than a decade of leadership by a party accused of corruption and tied to organized crime. The world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
The votes were still being tallied late last night, but the streets in Honduras's biggest cities had already erupted in celebration. Free Party candidate Xiomara Castro declared herself the winner as she appeared before supporters in the capital of Tegucigalpa. She's a three-time presidential candidate and wife of former President Juan Manuel Zelaya.
Revertimos el autoritarismo
y revertimos el continuismo.
We rejected authoritarianism, Castro told the crowd. She's referring to the outgoing presidency of Juan Orlando Hernández, who's long been accused of corruption and connected to drug trafficking investigations by U.S. law enforcement. Gustavo Irias is executive director of the Center for the Study of Democracy, a think tank in Tegucigalpa.
Bueno, con un optimismo histórico, realmente el país...
Irias says he woke up this morning with a feeling of historic optimism.
Honduras es un país que venía padeciendo desde hace 12 años un régimen realmente autoritario luego...
Honduras is a country that has been suffering from authoritarian rule for 12 years, Irias explains. So here's some background. In 2009, armed soldiers took then-President Juan Manuel Zelaya from his home and expelled him from the country. The conservative National Party took control, and party leader Juan Orlando Hernández was eventually sworn into office amid claims of election fraud. Hernández oversaw a period in which food, gas, and electricity prices skyrocketed, as did migration toward the U.S. The DEA has connected Hernández and other party leaders to multiple drug trafficking investigations.
Bueno, realmente la tarea es bien compleja, honestamente. No.
So Gustavo Irias explains that the task to eradicate corruption will not be easy for anyone. Karen Spring is a human rights researcher who has lived in Honduras since 2009. She explains that a Xiomara Castro presidency would be significant for several reasons.
Well, she's going to be the first woman president in Honduras, which is historical, obviously, for a country that has very serious machismo and patriarchal issues that they face in all different levels of the country.
Spring explains that Castro has promised to reverse many of the previous government's economic policies.
So, for example, I think that she will invest more in education and healthcare. I think that she'll help reduce electrical energy costs for families.
And while it's expected that Castro will be officially declared winner, she was 20 percentage points ahead of the closest candidate as of this morning, Congress is still up for grabs. Karen Spring says members of Congress will be instrumental in fighting corruption.
They're going to elect a new Supreme Court, a new Attorney General, new commissioners that will oversee the state auditing body, which are really critical for corruption cases and drug trafficking cases.
All of which are factors that contribute to staggering poverty rates and the recent mass exodus from Honduras, explains Gabriela Amador, executive director of the Washington-based Pro-Honduras Network.
De primera instancia, creo que esto no va a ser un efecto inmediato.
Amador says she doesn't believe any new government can immediately change the circumstances pushing people out of Honduras. But she says that if Castro fulfills her promises of providing better education, health care, and security, then change could be on its way. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Cancel culture. You might see it as political correctness run amok. You might see it as calling out discrimination or bigotry when it's spotted. The political debate over cancel culture has a very American ring to it. But as The World's Patrick Wynn reports, the same debate in another country is even inspiring new laws.
The phrase cancel culture has jumped out of the American zeitgeist and landed with a thud in Australia. Prime Minister Scott Morrison talks about it a lot. He says religious folks in Australia, like himself, a Pentecostal Christian, are worried. He says they have to take a stand.
Against the prevalence of cancel culture in Australian life. It's true. It's there. It's real.
The Prime Minister recently said this in Parliament, where he is pushing a law specifically to protect people from being cancelled.
Australians shouldn't have to worry about looking over their shoulder, fearful of offending an anonymous person on Twitter, cowardly, sitting there abusing and harassing them for their faith.
So does Scott Morrison want to control what people say on Twitter? Well, no, he can't do that. But he is tapping the unease over cancel culture to promote his religious discrimination law, which he wants lawmakers to pass ASAP, as soon as this week. The bill does have plenty of critics, though. Here's Ghassan Kasasia, legal director at Equality Australia. It promotes LGBTQ rights.
You know, the idea of cancel culture in this frame of debate, no one's really explained how it even locks in with what's proposed and what's on the table.
What's proposed is a law that would make it harder to fire someone who says discriminatory things in the name of religion, or to sue a business such as a bakery that doesn't want to make a cake for a gay couple. Yes, that cake example, inspired by the U.S. Supreme Court case, is specifically mentioned in the Australian bill. Casasia says this law would enable discrimination in all sorts of places.
If you can imagine you visit your doctor and your doctor turns around and says, look, I think your AIDS is a punishment from God or your disability is caused by the devil, those sorts of comments would today constitute discrimination.
And that could get you fired. But if the new law passes, someone could just say, you can't cancel my employment, I'm just sharing my religious views. Certain religious groups in Australia, including Catholic bishops, they love this proposed law. They say Australia protects people from being bullied in the workplace over race or sexual orientation, but overlooks the rights of religious folks to speak their minds. But just to be clear, firing or not hiring someone because they are Baptist or Muslim or any religion, that is already illegal.
Religious freedom, rightly, is alive and well in Australia, and it doesn't need a bill in the way that this one's been framed to protect it from a threat that's imagined.
Further confusing the situation is the fact that cancel culture in Australia or America usually doesn't have much to do with the justice system. For example, there was a recent mini-scandal in Australia over a beer called Colonial Beer. Some say the beer glorifies colonialism and no one should buy it. Others said that is oversensitive and absurd. But in the end, people mostly yell at each other online and move on to the next thing. Again, here's Ghassan Casasia from Equality Australia.
I'm not sure why the phrase is even being invoked in this debate. It's about winding back protections for people so that they don't have consequences when they say offensive things to others in their workplace or when they access goods and services.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the proposed religious discrimination law isn't meant to hurt anyone. It's a shield, he says, not a sword. But it's already excited religious conservatives, Scott Morrison's base, and he is gearing up for an election early next year. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
In Vienna today, the Iran nuclear talks are restarting. The Obama administration negotiated the landmark agreement in 2015. The Trump administration pulled out of it. Now the Biden administration says it'd like to find a path to rejoining. Senior Iran analyst Nesan Rafati at the Crisis Group has been following the Iran nuclear negotiations pretty closely. So give us a setup, if you would, Nesan. Who's at the table and what is at stake?
Well, who's at the table are the P4 plus one. That's the four permanent members of the Security Council and Germany, who are still parties to the agreement, Iran and the United States. The United States, as you mentioned, negotiated the deal originally in 2015. But since the U.S. withdrawal, there's a bit of dispute over the nomenclature. So the P4 plus one, Iran and the U.S., carrying out negotiations indirectly between the Americans and the Iranians. So the stakes are pretty substantial. Ever since the Trump administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018, Iran has been expanding its nuclear program on the argument that if it's not receiving sanctions relief, then it's not obligated to comply with the deal's nuclear provisions. And so over the past 2 years, we've seen breakout time shrink to around a month. That's the time it would take to accumulate the nuclear material required for a weapon. So that's what the stakes are for the P4 plus one in the U.S. going into these negotiations, is an Iranian nuclear program that's more of a concern and increasingly less monitored, because Iran has also been stymieing inspections access by the International Atomic Energy Agency. On the Iranian side, the stakes are that U.S. sanctions have had a substantial impact on Iran's economy over the past 3 years. And despite the fact that they are now re-entering positive growth territory in terms of GDP, exports, inflation, unemployment, all of those are quite significant concerns in Tehran right now.
So it was the Obama administration that brokered the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran. President Trump, of course, said it was a terrible deal and pulled out. The Biden White House obviously can't just jump back right in. But what is the position of the Biden White House on a new deal and what it should contain?
I think part of the issue is this discussion of a new deal isn't really a discussion of a new deal. It's, for now, restoring the 2015 agreement. What the Biden administration has said is that they are willing to negotiate over the lifting of U.S. sanctions that they say are inconsistent with the JCPOA. So that means lifting some, even many, but certainly not all of the 1,500 or so sanctions that the Trump administration put in place. The Iranians have come into Vienna with substantially more maximalist demand. They want not just all of those sanctions removed, but they also want guarantees that the U.S. won't leave the agreement again. Mm. And obviously, the Biden administration says that, well, we can tell you what we'll do during our term in office, but there's nothing, even a treaty, that a future president would not abrogate in 2025 if there's a change in government here.
So, Nason, as you said, Iran has been enriching uranium, and UN nuclear inspectors have been unable to fully monitor the nuclear program in Iran because Tehran limited their access. Do you think the presence of talks in Vienna will change any of that behavior in Iran?
Well, look, I think we're literally right now in the middle of day one of the first round of negotiations with this new government. I think that a lot of this, speaking to people that have been involved in preparing for these negotiations, I think there's a sense that at least in the first few days, it's going to be a fairly attritional, almost diplomatic equivalent of trench warfare. While the P4 plus one takes stock of the Raisi team, the Raisi team comes in with their own expectations of what they can get in terms of sanctions relief. So I think for both sides, there is a clear imperative in terms of non-proliferation for the P4 plus one in the US, the economic dividend for Iran. So the question is going to be, are those gaps bridgeable, not just in the coming days, but potentially over future rounds, or do we drift our way towards a growing nuclear crisis over the next couple of months?
Nason Rafati is senior Iran analyst with the Crisis Group, speaking with us about day one of new Iran nuclear negotiations taking place in Vienna today. Nason, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
At one time, the richest country in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, invested billions of dollars in Lebanon. Now the Lebanese economy is in free fall. The situation has only gotten worse since the Saudis recently slapped an import ban on all Lebanese goods. The last straw for the Saudi government was a comment by a minister in Lebanon last month criticizing the war in Yemen. The world's Shirin Jafari reports from Beirut on the impact of the Saudi blockade.
Abdul Ghani Ghanoum has found himself thinking a lot about the sea, specifically the waters between the coast of Lebanon and Turkey. For this 24-year-old, that's what stands between a life of endless struggle here in Lebanon and a chance at a more stable one in Turkey. We live paycheck to paycheck, he says. No matter how much I work, I still don't earn enough to make ends meet. Ghanoum works at a paper factory on the outskirts of Beirut. He does all kinds of work here, from feeding giant rolls of paper into machines to cutting and binding papers together to make notebooks and calendars. He says his meager paycheck has shrunk even more in the last year or so because Lebanon's currency has lost its value. Ghanoum makes about $85 a month, but his friends who went to live in Turkey say they're making about $400 a month working at a coal factory. He says he wants to join them. Recently, Ghanoum found a smuggler who said he can take him to Turkey on a boat. It would cost him about $400 to get there, Ghanoum says. So he saved up some money and borrowed the rest. But the more he thought about it, the more he worried about the dangers. People are drowning at sea, he says. After discussing the idea with his wife, Ghanoum says he changed his mind. He decided he's not ready to take the risk. That is until a few weeks ago, when he heard the news about Saudi Arabia banning imports from Lebanon. The kingdom is where his company sells many of its paper products. CEO Ziad Bakhtar says orders of notebooks and calendars have been sitting in the warehouse since the announcement.
And nobody will take it because it was a personalized order for a special client.
Last year, Lebanon exported just over $200 million worth of goods to Saudi Arabia. That included things like chocolate, paper products, and jewelry. Bakhtash, who is also the head of the Association of Lebanese Industrialists, says the plan was to boost exports to Saudi Arabia to $600 million by next year. But now everything has come to a halt.
This is a big impact for us. We will lose in 2022 around $400 or $500 million export to Saudi Arabia.
Relations between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon have been sour for a while, but tensions intensified last April when Saudi customs officials seized a large shipment of Captagon, an illegal amphetamine, hidden in a shipment of pomegranates from Lebanon. In response, Saudi Arabia banned imports of Lebanese fruits. That was a huge blow to farmers here. Mike Azar, a financial expert based in Beirut, says the political tension with Saudi Arabia could put another important source of revenue in jeopardy.
There's a large Lebanese diaspora in the Gulf countries, especially in Saudi, and they work there and earn a living there. But also they send remittances back home. And the Lebanese economy has become really dependent on remittances, especially in the last 2 years.
Azar says these remittances make up about 40% of Lebanon's GDP.
So Lebanon's relationship with the Gulf is very fundamental, at least from an economic perspective. It's very fundamental to the Lebanese economy.
Baktash, the CEO of the paper company, says he's thinking about relocating his operations outside of Lebanon.
I was 2 weeks ago in Muscat, Oman, to find out what are the opportunities and the subsidies that we can get from Muscat, Oman. We're going next week to the UAE. I'm trying to find out as well in Egypt.
That could mean laying off his 70 employees. People like Tarek Yunus, who's been working as plant manager for the past 5 years. Yunus says he's already posted his resume on job hunting websites.
I have to interview in the two next months on the Christmas vacation, and maybe if I succeed, I will travel.
Yuna says he's got one interview with a construction company and another one at a cosmetics factory, but they're in Ghana and Nigeria. His options are limited, he says, because now he can't get a visa to any of the Gulf countries because of the Saudi ban.
If I am traveling to Europe, once I said the Lebanese, you are a refugee, maybe you are coming and you are not going back to your home country.
Going to the U.S., he says, is almost impossible because it's difficult to get a visa. So he's focused on Africa. Yunus supports his parents here in Lebanon and says he worries about leaving them behind.
The idea I'm traveling are difficult for them.
But for now, he doesn't have much choice. He has to make a living, he says. If not in Lebanon, it has to be somewhere else. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari in Beirut, Lebanon.
Shirin's reporting from Lebanon continues this week with stories about the country's deep political and economic dysfunction. Head over to our website, theworld.org, to learn more. And check out the pictures Shirin sent us, photos that will show you what chronic electricity shortages look like after the sun sets in Beirut. That's on our website, theworld.org. The struggle of making a living in Lebanon right now, an extreme example of a country that seemingly has nowhere to go but up. Here's a musical message of hope in a new single from Mali's Rokia Kone. The song is titled Nyan Nyan, based on an old song passed down over time. It reminds listeners that bad things do not go on forever. Rokia Kone recorded it in one take on a night when the world around her was in upheaval, August of 2020, when there was a coup d'etat in Mali. You can hear how she found solace in the words, "Things may be bad now, but it's only a moment in time." New music there from Mali's Rokia Kone. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online all the time at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you right here again tomorrow. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.